On the program today, the spreading economic effects here and everywhere of the war over there. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday today. This one is the 7th of March. Good as always to have you along, everybody. You know, one hesitates a lot to make too much of what's happening here or happening anywhere, really, that's not Ukraine, in light of what's happening on the ground over there. The trick is to cover the global economic effects of a war that put what's happening in that economy, the global economy, into context. So here is just a little bit of that context. Wheat prices, which we have talked about a lot, mostly by way of mentioning that Russia and Ukraine together are something like 25% of global exports of it. Wheat prices have traded limit up for 6 days in a row now. That is, they have gone up as much as commodities exchanges are willing to let them go up for 6 straight days. That's a macroeconomic effect of war. Here's another one that we all see in foot-high numbers every single time we look around. The national average for a gallon of gas, you probably know this already, is $4.06, says AAA. It makes sense when you think about all the talk of us banning the import of Russian oil and gas. Here's a catch, though. We don't rely all that much on Russian oil here in the United States. So what gives with these prices? Marketplace's Justin Ho gets us going.
Gasoline prices reflect a lot of factors. Supply and demand, for one. Also, state and local taxes, transportation costs for moving gas around.
But the main contributing factor to the price of gasoline is the price of crude oil.
That's Devin Gladden at AAA. He says crude oil prices make up around 55% of what we pay for gas. And those crude prices are rising because oil traders are getting nervous about a possible ban on Russian oil exports. Tom Tsang is director of the School of Energy at the University of Tulsa.
We haven't seen official bans out there, but if you're a trader, you have to believe that something is going to happen.
The concern is that sanctions on Russian oil would cause oil prices to rise in the future. As a result, Tsang says traders are buying oil now, which pushes prices up today.
Being concerned that prices could run up is sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy at this point in time.
Those higher crude prices mean refineries have to spend more on the crude oil they turn into gasoline, says Bob McNally, president of Rapidan Energy Group.
And the refiners have to pass that along to consumers as the price of crude oil goes up.
McNally says it usually takes around 3 weeks for a jump in oil prices to show up at the pump. That means gas is likely to get more expensive.
You should start to see a roughly 10 to 15% increase in gasoline prices, assuming these crude oil prices stick.
But if they don't and oil prices fall, we shouldn't expect gasoline prices to drop as quickly as they've risen, says Severin Bornstein at UC Berkeley.
It's known as the rockets and feather effect. They go up like rockets and come down like feathers.
Bornstein says that's because people tend to pay more attention when oil prices are rising. When crude prices go down,
people just breathe a sigh of relief. They continue to go to their station they've been going to. They don't shop around very much. That lowers the competitive pressure.
And he says that means gas stations can get away with charging higher prices for longer. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today. Oh, did I not mention this somehow? Forget about it. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. All right, so let's do some more oil and gas, American oil and gas this time, because part of the conversation about cutting off the Russians is about boosting production here. Andy Euler has told us, I can't tell you how many times, about all the production we've got in the Permian Basin in Texas and up in the Bakken Shale in North Dakota. So you might fairly ask, why in the heck are we importing oil at all? As Mr. Euler explains, it's part chemistry, part economics.
When oil refiners talk about crude, they generally ask two questions. First, how easy is it to break up the hydrocarbons to produce, say, gasoline or jet fuel? In oil speak, the question is, how light is it? Second, how much sulfur is in the oil? If there isn't much, it's called sweet crude. Hugh Daigle teaches petroleum engineering at the University of Texas.
You know, higher sulfur content, more sour crudes actually are cheaper to purchase.
That's because they take longer to process, and they also need specialized refining equipment. This cheap, lower-quality crude comes from Canada, Venezuela, and Russia, among other spots. And back in the late 1990s and early 2000s...
a lot of refineries, or you know, especially in the Gulf Coast, made a very expensive bet.
Richard Sweeney is an assistant professor of economics at Boston College.
To invest in this equipment that would allow them to save money on input costs by processing, you know, lower-quality crude.
Then came the fracking boom, which produces light, sweet crude that you can't refine with that equipment.
And it's just like the economics of that bet turned out ex post to be really bad.
Now, even though a lot of light, sweet crude is coming from Texas, where the refineries are, the U.S. imports foreign oil in order to make use of the existing infrastructure. Ryan Kellogg teaches environmental policy at the University of Chicago.
They spent billions of dollars on this refining capacity in the 90s and early 2000s. They're not going to want to let it sit idle. It's there. They want to use it. It makes sense to use it.
But hold on. There's got to be a way for refineries to retrofit their operations to make use of more domestically produced oil, right? Again, Hugh Daigle at the University of Texas.
That is, you know, something we could do. It would require some reconfiguring of the refineries, but does it make economic sense for the refining companies to do that?
Reconfiguring refineries costs a lot of money. So why do it if companies can still turn a profit using their existing platform? Now, to be fair, the U.S. refining system is processing more light, sweet domestic crude than it used to. But we're still nowhere near the point where the U.S. can stop importing heavier sour oil from abroad. The upshot? Since 2020, the U.S. is a net exporter of oil, sending a lot of its light, sweet crude to Europe and Asia, where refineries are equipped to deal with the kind of oil coming out of West Texas and North Dakota. In Austin, I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
This week, Friday, actually, makes it 2 years that the World Health Organization officially called the pandemic a pandemic. And in the weeks and months that followed, we talked to people all over the world about how it was changing their work and their businesses. So today we have gotten some of them back on the phone for an update. First up is Eric Ju. He's the director of United Textiles of America. That's a factory in Choloma, Honduras, that produces polyester yarn.
Business demand is very strong, but inflationary pressures and all of the price increases that have been happening have been making it very difficult to plan for the future. You can see the pain at the gas pump, but also it's in hitting our polyester prices, which is petroleum-derived. Prices are going up. Inflation is hitting here in Honduras as well, so it's making people have more difficulties by buying their basic necessities. You know, it's mostly price of gas, which not a lot of our workers directly purchase. Some of them do, some of them don't, but also mostly related to foodstuff prices. I mean, food prices have been going up. Most of our product inputs are directed towards the U.S. consumer. So I'm concerned about how their spending power is going to be affected. You know, if demand shrinks, then, of course, our end market may shrink as well. So we'll see how that balance ends up at the end of the day and how people spend their money. Just hope that people have enough money to spend.
Eric Ju there in Choloma, Honduras. The destruction the Russian invasion of Ukraine has brought, as well as the dislocation, there are something like 1.5 million refugees now, according to the United Nations. They're terrible. But as we've said for the past couple of weeks, I think the ripple effects of this war are spreading pretty wide. According to the Institute of International Education, something like 6,500 Ukrainian and Russian students were in college or graduate school here in the United States last year. And if being abroad during a pandemic has not been difficult enough, now they have to deal with war and the changing economies back home. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab is on that one.
For the past several months, Hanna Onyshenko has needed some extra emotional support at school. She's a PhD student in economics at the University of Michigan, and her parents live in northern Ukraine. So she's been seeing a therapist.
I'm doing steps to normalize my mental health, but for example, today I got like some bad news and I'm back to the spiral.
Her grandfather just died of a stroke, and not only is it unsafe to go home, it's practically impossible to get there. So she's been putting a lot of energy into helping other students on campus who need not just support socially, but also financially, students who don't get a PhD stipend like she does.
Yeah, so the biggest worry is for undergrad students, because many of their parents had lost their income, and they are not able to cover next semester of tuition.
It's just one of several reasons why Ukrainian students might be struggling financially. Jason Siz is with the Institute of International Education, which provides emergency grants to students.
They're unable to get the physical movement of funds. They're no longer able to contact through internet or telephone because that infrastructure might have been destroyed, or the people on the other end simply don't have access to the devices that they need to.
And it's not just about today, but about tomorrow. As students approach the end of the school year, those who can't or don't feel safe returning home will have to find housing and a way to pay for it. Terry Hartle is with the American Council on Education, and he thinks universities are prepared.
We've actually just been through something that has very well prepared us for this, which was the sudden closure of campuses in COVID with a million international students in the United States.
And even the Ukrainians that are graduating will be able to stay. The Department of Homeland Security is giving Ukrainians temporary protected status for 18 months. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
Continuing our brief survey of the global economy, we stop by Milan right now, the hub, obviously, of the Italian fashion industry, which has seen a rocky couple of years because of the pandemic. And that gets us to our next dispatch. Raffaella Grasso is the owner of Pino Grasso Embroidery. They make embroidery for dresses at some of the big fashion houses over there.
At the moment, everything seems to be slowing down more than before. Expenses are still very high, especially now with all the problem with gas and energy, and work is not enough to go on. At the moment, the problem is that all is very, very uncertain. And being so uncertain, everything slowed down. Parties and big events and all the happenings that will attract people with very luxury dresses are few.
Raffaella Grasso, she's in Milan. One more dispatch from this global economy of ours coming up. Coming up.
At this point, what we're looking for is stability.
Yeah, we are. First, though, let's do the numbers. Wow, I totally had this down for the Wawas, man. Holy cow. Dow Industrial is down 797 today, 2.4%, 32,817. The NASDAQ off 482 points, 3.6%, 12,830. S&P 500 off 127 points, just shy of 3%, finished at 42-1, did the S&P. So to quote Martha Stewart, oil. Energy stocks were up today. Duke Energy grew 1.3%. Chevron flowed up 2.1%. ExxonMobil gained 3.6%. Banks fell on, yes, concerns about economic growth. Citigroup gave back 1.8%. Wells Fargo slowed more than 6% today. Bank of America slumped 6.3%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year Treasury notes up to 1.77%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Let us recap, shall we, where Russia stands in the global economy going on 3 weeks now into their invasion of Ukraine. The ruble continues to crumble. The Moscow Stock Exchange still closed and set to stay that way for a while. Russia's international credit rating downgraded to junk or near junk by Moody's and Fitch and S&P Global as the odds of the government and major Russian companies defaulting on their debt rises. There is talk, in the meanwhile, as I'm sure you've heard, by U.S. and European leaders of extending international sanctions to cover Russian energy exports. Those exports, by the way, are Russia's last unsanctioned source of foreign currency. And it sure seems that what could be happening here is a Russia truly cut off from the global economy, something not often, if ever, seen for an economy its size. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has that one.
Russia has the 11th biggest economy in the world, or it did until it was hit with massive financial and trading sanctions over the past couple weeks. And they're increasingly disrupting business and consumer life in Russia, cutting Russians off from necessities and luxuries alike. Josh Lipsky directs the Geoeconomic Center at the Atlantic Council.
Technology imports, iPhones, computers, medical supplies. So to take that away from them, I think is almost impossible to think there wouldn't be serious repercussions domestically.
Now, Russia's oil and gas exports haven't been blocked so far, but sanctions are cutting into them, says Jay Hatfield at ICAP.
The global transportation and trading companies have not been able to get financing for cargoes, and that's already restricted the flow of Russian oil.
And Josh Lipsky says if oil and gas revenues in dollars and euros were shut down,
it would be a significant blow to one of their last economic lifelines that is stabilizing the Russian economy.
And it would mark Russia's near total isolation, something called autarky in economic theory, says Lipsky.
There are elements of autarky that we are headed to in terms of a closed system. The question is Russia prepared? Is Putin prepared to have that kind of system in place where a ruble and the rest of the economy is closed off?
This wouldn't necessarily spell the end of the Russian economy, says Columbia political economist Sharon O'Halloran. Russians could still buy stuff produced domestically.
The ruble will still be printed. It will still be valued for their internal market. If Russia wants to build its own pens and pencils and paper and so forth, well, that's fine. But it's going to be very expensive for them to do that.
And we've never seen it done in an economy as big and complicated as Russia's. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
We've talked about remittances a bit on the program over the years, money that expats working overseas send to their families back home. And usually, to be honest, we talk about it when something's happened to interrupt that flow of cash, cash that can be critical to personal and national economies. According to the World Bank, remittances account for just under 10% of Ukrainian gross national product. That is 10% of their entire economy. Remittances are, of course, a global phenomenon. But Ukrainians living in the United States, and this is before the invasion, to be clear, it's also before the pandemic, too, actually, but Ukrainians sent more than $500 million a year back home. Given the situation on the ground over there right now, though, it is just hard to get cash into the hands of family and friends who need it. Marketplace's Lily Jamali has that story from San Francisco.
In San Francisco's Richmond district, there's a mixed Ukrainian and Russian neighborhood known locally as Little Russia. Bogdan Vasahan sat in his car on a corner there, glued to his phone.
I'm basically all on social media constantly and checking all the updates on the news and videos.
Vasahan is a contractor. His hometown is the port city of Odessa in southern Ukraine. Residents there are bracing for a possible Russian assault. His mom and grandma are among them. He's been looking for a chance to wire them cash.
We've been communicating about sending the support, but I've been told by them that right now banks are not operating, not fulfilling the transactions. You know, you can't really do anything right now.
He's worried they'll run out of food or medicine, or won't be able to afford to get out of there if they need to. For those with relatives further east in Ukraine, the situation is even more desperate. Yulia Lapativa is from Zaporizhia, a city where Russians have reportedly taken control of the nuclear power plant.
I have my brother, twin brother, live there. Our friends, my cousins, sisters.
A few days after we met, Lapativa's brother had a stroke. He couldn't get medical help amid the war and died. She's been trying to send money for funeral services with no luck. People here depend on one of three main companies to send cash home: MoneyGram, Western Union, and Ria. MoneyGram says remittances sent to Ukraine more than doubled on the day of the invasion, but didn't provide more recent data. The company says it is still providing service in the country. Ria, on the other hand, says services there right now are limited. Nicholas Varone, a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics, says like every business, this one has its own unique supply chain.
So there are lots of links in that chain, and at this point, all these links may be affected. It's not just cash. Everything is difficult in a war zone.
At the end of that chain, cash itself may be in short supply. And the ability to pick up cash depends a lot on where in Ukraine a person is. Russian forces have been bombarding the country's second largest city, Kharkiv. Some of Bay Area resident Michael Dvorkin's family is there. When we spoke last week, he said they couldn't retrieve the money he wanted to send.
We asked the relatives, and they said there is no point because we can't get it anyways. So they cannot go outside because they're scared of being killed.
It took a few days, but Dvorkin says someone there was finally able to get some money to his family. No banks, no wire transfers, just cash passing from one hand to another as a favor. In San Francisco, I'm Lily Jamali for Marketplace.
All right, for the final leg of our short world economic survey, we're going to Vancouver. That is where the Pacific National Exhibition is, PNE, it's called for short. It's a big event space, over 100 acres with concert halls and fairgrounds and amusement parks. PNE saw its business basically collapse at the beginning of the pandemic. And when I spoke with Shelley Frost, the CEO, there were $52 million in the hole. So 2 years on now, we decided to see how things are going.
I can honestly say that business is a lot better than it was, 18 months to 2 years ago. Our restrictions have lifted. Our capacities have lifted. We can see people being willing to come back out and do group activities, which is absolutely awesome. At this point, what we're looking for is stability. We're looking to see tours and music tours and things like that come out more regularly. There's still some people that are sitting on the fence. They're touring the US, but they're maybe not jumping up into Canada yet. That's always a concern. We're very much focused on rebuilding our team. Inflation in general is just really, is something that we're always keeping an eye on because we depend on people's disposable income. So you want to come out and you want to do fun activities and you want to do things with your family and friends. But if you can't pay for the basics, then you've got less room in your, just in your monthly budget to be able to do things like that.
Shelley Frost, she's running PNE up in Vancouver, Canada. Final note on the way out today. We started with commodities. We will end with commodities. Nickel prices today, biggest single day jump ever. Why, you ask? Well, here's why. Russia, as it happens, is the world's number three producer of the metal that goes into stuff like, electric vehicle batteries. Tesla shares, by the way, today, interestingly enough, down 4%. All right, we're out of here. Very quick moment of economic context. Not to belabor the point, but West Texas Intermediate, The American benchmark crude up 3% on the day, $119 a barrel. Brent crude, that is, of course, the global benchmark, up 5%, about $124.26 a barrel. So we'll see where this all goes. Our daily production team includes Anais Amin, Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.